Okay, thanks for coming. Could you shut the door at the back, please? Thank you very much indeed. You all hear me all right? This is obviously the last lecture of this module, and it's literally so because the module will not exist in its present form in future. It's going to be changed into a chronologically wider-ranging and globally further-reaching module, which is going to be called Modern World Literatures, rather than literature in the modern world. And your input into the questionnaires and so on has been very helpful and will be passed to those who are going to be running that module from next year. I'm on leave next year, so I won't be teaching it. If you have questions about the exam, I'll try and answer them at the end, but I imagine that you've raised them already with your tutors and got answers. So limit yourselves to things that you haven't already asked and had a response to. The first item on the handout that you have here is an extract from a novel not on the module, quite recent, called On Chesil Beach by Ian McEwan, and it raises all sorts of questions. Not least what a novel is, because it's very short. But I want to make the first paragraph an introduction to some aspects of what I'll be talking about, which are aspects of writing which aren't to do with society or the modern world or externals, or not entirely so, but in which issues to do with form and rhythm are more important. The first paragraph you can read for yourselves quickly. I talked in the beginning of this module about the impossibility or the near impossibility of abstract writing because of the fact that words have associations and meanings in a way of a paraphrasable kind in a way that music doesn't. But there are important aspects of writing which work to some extent separately from meaning, and one of these, if you like, is tempo, rhythm and pace. On Chesil Beach, as those of you who've read it will know, is narrated in the third person, and it has four main narrative lines, the situation that is moving forward between the central couple, the as seen by the narrator, and interwoven with that, the thoughts and the anxieties and the reactions of the main male character, Edward, and the thoughts, anxieties, and reactions of Florence. So those are the second two strands. And finally, a series of flashbacks to the earlier lives of each of them and of them both together. That so much is conventional, as also is a double pressure, but I say it's conventional, but it's particularly characteristic, I think, of McEwan's work. A double pressure between wanting to know what's going to happen, but also not wanting to, because the pleasure of what's happening on any individual page makes you resist the temptation of rushing forward to the end. And that is, in the traditional narrative, plot-driven, what's going to happen, terribly important. What is it, not only that keeps the reader pressing forward, but also what stops the reader from saying, well, okay, what I want to know is what happens, skipping to the end, finding out, and then saying, okay, that's that, I don't need to know the rest. And this double pressure is taken to a particular extreme by McEwan. I won't be giving away anything plot-wise if you haven't read the book. If I tell you that of the book's 166 pages, 160 are concerned with a single evening, the evening of the wedding of Edward and Florence, but including retrospective summaries about the couple's earlier lives. And the last six pages are a coda, everything that happens in the rest of their lives. The coda has a particular emphasis which I can't explain without spoiling the story. But in using the word coda, I'm using a musical term, of course, and like most musical terms, it's Italian in origin. It means a tale. The coda is something that comes after the end, if you like, but which is still part of the whole. And it's music that the two characters of this novel divide on, among other things. McEwan's musical responsiveness can be seen not only in how his novels are constructed, but in their musical interests, and indeed in their use of tempo. This is a novel in which Edward has one tempo and Florence has another. Florence's musical interests are classical and Edward's are pop. Music is a big part of it. But what I'm talking about generally, and I'm going on now to set texts, is these musical and other aspects of writing. Writing in itself and writing about writing, not literary criticism as a special activity, but those areas when a text, as it were, comments on itself. This passage in On Chesil Beach is about classical music. It also obliquely draws attention to the ways in which tempo and music are used in the text. But it's also made clear here that Edward doesn't really understand much about tempo, and that's going to be very important to what happens between the couple. Now let me turn immediately to theatre, and particularly to Samuel Beckett. Tempo is particularly important in theatre because it's regulated for us. As readers, we can't do anything. As readers, we can do anything we like with tempo up to a point. We can put the book down, pick it up, read a page slowly, read it fast, skip to the end, go back to the beginning. But if we're in the theatre, what comes at us is what we get. The tempo, we can't skip, we can't change the pace. I watched last night Bertolucci's movie of Paul Bowles' novel, The Sheltering Sky. And never have I wished more that I could change the tempo of the movie, which of course I could technically by speeding it forward. There was a classic case of somebody letting tempo be indulged to a point at which it becomes stultifying. That's very much a digression. Theatre dictates its tempo then, and it's, on the other hand, literary in the sense that it has a narrative, and that, like in opera or movies, words are important to it. But it isn't abstract like a symphony or a ballet. But it's different from a published text in the sense that it's visual and dynamic, as well as that it happens, as I've said, in real time. You go at its pace, not it at yours. And then there's the fact that it's social and not private, that the audience is part of what happens, that your awareness of and your reactions to how other people are reacting can be part of the experience. So it has a physical existence beyond the signs on the page. And this isn't entirely to its advantage, necessarily. The director and the performers can affect the author's work in ways which the author didn't anticipate and might not want. I'll come back to this in a minute. But in another way, it's evident that it can be, the work can exist on the stage in and of itself. And this is particularly true of much of Beckett's work. To say anything about Godot, you have to talk about it as a piece of performance. You cannot think of it, I think, in another way. And I'll say the same about some poems in a moment. And Beckett's work, more than most dramatists, explores the potential of particular media, particular forms of presenting drama in his time. So, for example, he was one of the first to experiment with radio drama and the particular connection between intimacy between audience and performance over the radio in a play called All That Fall, 1957. In Crap's Last Tape, 1959, he was, I think, the first dramatist to explore the potential of personal recording devices, in this case an old-style tape recorder with spools going round and round and round, and a guy who's keeping a diary on a tape and keeping the spools and listening to his own past by playing old fragments of old tapes. It's a simple play, but a very powerful one, in which we see and hear memory in a kind of action. Or there's the play Endgame, about a play about endings of many different sorts, in which an elderly couple called Nag and Nell are kept in a pair of dustbins by a younger pair of characters, also physically constricted in a different way. You can go on and on about what these plays mean, or about the cultural and historical circumstances which contributed to those meanings, but the uniqueness of the work lies in what is put and what isn't put into the performance arena, what happens rather than what it means. Harold Pinter, who learnt a lot as a dramatist from Samuel Beckett, had something to say about this, and interestingly, what he wrote about Beckett, which is on the handout on about Godot, which is on page one of the handout, top of the right-hand side, was written before he'd seen the play, in response to something somebody had written to him, a letter describing Godot and asking questions about it. And Pinter says the course of the play, page one, top of the page on the right, the course of the play, its texture and its characters, sound undeniable. Remember, he hasn't seen it. But is it Beckett's business to answer questions he himself poses? I don't see that. It seems to me that as he does not answer his question, his message can only be that he, for one, cannot see or is not prepared to hazard an answer. In other words, surely the sole and necessary answer to the question is the play itself. If the question was answered explicitly, the question would cease to exist. It would be consumed in the answer. There would be no impulse, no work, no play. Both in Beckett and Kafka, surely, and that's an interesting connection, you get all the questions, and any answer you want off any shelf in any permutation according to your taste and disposition. I prefer the term gut ache, a major irritation, a most stern and ruthless activity without question or answer, a necessity. The necessity to what? The necessity to say. To say what? Whatever's to be said. It is to be said. It is said. Some people say it better than others. So that is Pinter's response to a play that he hadn't seen. And his point can be illustrated, I think, by two other Beckett pieces which you haven't studied. One is printed in full on your handout, and the other takes only 3 minutes to perform. So although you don't have to refer to these, it's a rule of the module that we don't introduce new set texts in this term. You may do, because in the exam you can refer to anything relevant, show the range of your knowledge and experience, while focusing primarily in your answer on set texts. One of these plays is called Breath, and it's on the first page under that Pinter quote. And basically what happens in Breath, as you'll see if you read the text, which is simply what you have on page one, is that you hear somebody breathing in, and the curtain goes up very slowly, the lights go up with the curtain, but only to a dimness, and on the stage is a heap of rubbish. And slowly the curtains go down, the lights go down, and you hear a breath going out. That's the end. That's the play. There are all sorts of ways in which you can summarize that, but of course what matters is how it's done, and the kind of impact that it has on those who are watching it. The second is not quite as brief, and in some ways more complicated. You've got the stage directions on page two, or at least what you've got is the notes. On the left, you've got a diagram of how the characters sit. There are three women sitting on a bench, and first of all, they're sitting like this, Flo, Vi, and Rue, and then the positions change. Their costumes are described in detail. Full-length coats, different from each other. Hats, rather nondescript. The hats shading the faces, so you don't see the faces. Light shoes, and hands as visible as possible, but with no rings. The seat is a sort of bench that you can slide along. It's not particularly visible. And what happens in the play is the same thing three times. This is how it begins. You see, Vi is sitting in the middle, and Rue is sitting to one side of her. Vi says, "When did we three last meet?" And Rue says, "Let us not speak." There's a silence. And Vi gets up and very quietly goes into the darkness off the stage. That leaves Flo and Rue with a gap between them. And Flo says, "Rue?" And Rue says, "Yeah." And Flo says, "What do you think of Vi?" And Rue says, "I see you little change." At which point, Flo slides along to be beside Rue. You see it there in the stage patterning on the left of the notes. She whispers into her ear. We don't know what she says. Flo whispers into Rue's ear. Rue says, "Oh," says appalled. They look at each other. Flo puts her finger to her lips. And Rue says, "Does she not realize?" Flo says, "God grant not." At that moment, Vi comes back onto the stage and cannot not be aware of the fact that the positions of these characters have changed. Her seat has been taken. And she goes along to the end of the bench where Flo was sitting. See the pattern there? At which point, Flo says, who's now sitting in the middle, "Just sit together as we used to in the playground at Miss Wade's." And Rue says, "On the log." And there's silence. And then Flo gets up and goes off. The same pattern is repeated three times in all. Or technically speaking, repeated twice after the first time. Each time, two people are left, say, "What do you think of the person who's gone off stage?" Seems the same. Oh! And each time we don't know what it is. And the play, maybe, you know, her husband's continually unfaithful to her, that child that disappeared was found dead and tortured, anything. We just don't know. All we know is this sense of a past between these couples. And the play ends with them sitting in yet another configuration 7, but Vi back in the middle. And Vi says, "May we not speak of the old days?" "Of what came after?" Nobody says anything. And then she says, "Shall we hold hands in the old way?" You see the diagram at the bottom there on the left. She holds out her hands like this, and the characters on each side reach their outer hands onto hers and hold them, and their lower hands join across her, so that they're all holding hands in this very formal way, like a sort of Indian statue. And at that point, Flo says, "I can feel the rings." And the curtain falls. Now, we've been told in that costume direction, no rings apparent. So we don't know what she's talking about. And we can think, well, maybe there are rings that they gave each other when they were kids in the playground at Miss Wade's. And they're remembering that. Maybe it's the rings of this log, they say they're sitting on, which determine the age of the log. But the meaning, as Pinter says, is what we've seen. It may arouse associations in us, but it is what it is. Now, there are various ways in which one can talk about the play. It's very short, but it's a lot in it. As you heard, the first words are, "When did we three last meet?" Ring any bells? Somebody, yeah, what? Beginning of Macbeth, "When shall we three meet again?" So there's a kind of theatrical joke. You could imagine that these are some transformed witches from Macbeth who've been meeting over and over again. When did we, instead of saying, "When shall we three meet again?" they're now saying, "When did we three last meet?" I think it was in a production of Macbeth. So there's a theatrical history. But there's also to be considered not only that playfulness that Beckett always has, but the sternness with which he directs the action and the extent to which, in these later works, he seems to seek to control what the actors are doing, to limit the possibility of variation, even while at the same time he's handed himself over to a world in which actually and directly interpretation will always intervene between what he's put on the page and what the audience receives. And in thinking about that, you need to think about the fact that Beckett began as an experimental novelist. In 1934, with more pricks than kicks, and went on writing prose fiction. But it was his plays which made him famous and rich and which brought an audience to the prose fiction. My question, I suppose, here is the prose writer actually in more control of the response of the reader than the stage writer? There are certain obvious seeming answers, but I'm not sure that the obvious answers are necessarily the right one. The play, then, is, among other things, about itself. It's about coming and going, about entrances and exits. And those are, in a way, the most fundamental aspects of the form of drama, as well as of these particular plays, that particular play, Come and Go. And I want to make a similar point in a different way about a couple of poems now. And one of these is on the hand, both of them are on the handout. On the right of page two, there's William Carlos's Williams, The New Clouds, right of page two. And what I want you to think about here is that question of pressure that I was talking about before, pressure against what is actually on the page, pressure to read on, but the way in which you're also being held up. And it's here the enjambment against the line breaks that I'm drawing attention to. I'll exaggerate the line breaks in reading. "The morning that I first loved you had a quality of fine division about it, a lightness and a light full of small round clouds all rose upon the ground which bore them, a light of words upon a paper sky, each a meaning and all a meaning jointly. It was a quiet speech, at ease but reminiscent, and of praise with a disturbance of waiting. Yes, a page that glowed by all that it was not, a meaning more of meaning than the text whose separate edges were the edges of the sky." Now, separate edges, put in that very sharp way at the beginning of the last line, is in a sense what the poem is about, these separate edges of the lines and what is happening in them. But there are other things to draw attention to. First of all, the lines themselves are of irregular length, both in number of syllables and of stresses. But there's a regularity of music The vowels themselves make music. Every syllable in the first line is a separate, unrepeated vowel sound. The morning that I first loved you. Each of them is a different note, if you like. And the same is almost true of the second, though there's some repetition of short I's there. Now, by building up this, if you like, a pattern of variety, Williams arguably prepares the ear for the moments when he does the opposite. The repetition of lightness and light in line 3, and in line 4, the assonance of round and clouds and small and all. And in the case of round and clouds, that assonance or rhyme almost is quickly followed by a rhyme in the next line in ground and by another repetition of light from line 3 in line 5. So when the word meaning turns up at the enjambed line ending of line 6 and then is almost immediately repeated in the next line, we're startled into noticing that we don't necessarily care or notice what it all means exactly, except that the poem is about love and about good weather, the new clouds. It's a pathetic fallacy in the sense that it's connecting what's happening outside in the world of nature with what's happening inside the emotions. But it's also about poetry. The weather is in part the climate of the imagination, words upon a paper sky. Words upon a paper sky. That's in the middle there. Now, the word meaning is repeated again near the end, a meaning more of meaning, the antepenultimate and penultimate lines. And again, without trying to paraphrase any of this, because the point is surely that you can't, it's noticeable that one of the poem's formal aspects, that tension between enjambment and line breaks, corresponds with what's being said in the last line about the merging between the poem and the physical come emotional universe, whose separate edges were the edges of the sky, the text whose separate edges were the edges of the sky. Perhaps the white space around the poem is the sky, or perhaps you're being invited to cut out the poem and hold it up against the sky and see how it matches up. Now, again, there's a useful passage, I think, and it's on the back of the handout, something that Clive Willmer, a poet, wrote about another poet, Donald Davy, which he's summarising Davy's view, but also summarising something about Davy's writing, by saying the meaning of a poem is not something detached from it. This is at the top of the right-hand part of page 4. The meaning of a poem is not something detached from it, an interpretation we offer to the language, but something that grows in the experience of reading, and not just of understanding the words, but undergoing the drama of their disposition, the juxtapositions, the cadences, the line endings, the expected or unexpected chimes, the satisfaction or frustration of rhythmic expectations. So that what the new cloud does with line breaks, edges, in a way goes to the essence of what a poem is, not least because, as I reminded you in a previous lecture, the only thing you can certainly say about a poem by comparison with a piece of prose is that the length of the line is determined by the poet rather than by the edge of the page. And that's what defines prose, that it runs on according to how your program is set or according to the width of the page. There's no meaning to where the line breaks are in prose. Now, I'll just in parentheses mention that there's a problem here in these subtleties and nuances of to do with rhythm and cadence and sound, to do with translation. What, you remember I said to you that the lost in translation, that phrase in the movie title, comes from something Robert Frost said, which is poetry is what is lost in translation. How would you, if you have another language, translate the bishop poem, I'm coming on to a bishop poem, the Carlos Williams poem, in a way which would communicate all these aspects that I've been focusing on. And there's something similar to say about Elizabeth Bishop's One Art, which is on page 3 of the handout. I'm sorry, the handout's a bit muddled. And I'm sure a lot of you have focused on this poem, a very, very famous poem by Elizabeth Bishop. It's different from the Williams poem in various ways, not least is that in that it's in a regular and exceptionally demanding form, the villanelle. And the villanelle is defined in this way. It consists of 5 stanzas, each of 3 lines, plus a final quatrain. 5 stanzas of 3 lines, plus a final quatrain. There are only 2, this is the second definition, part of the definition, there are only 2 rhymes throughout. So it goes A, B, A. Thirdly, the first and third lines of the first stanza are repeated or echoed alternately in stanzas 2 and 4 as a refrain. So the art of losing isn't hard to master. The first line of the poem comes in the last line of stanza 2, of stanza 4, and to be their loss is no disaster is echoed. The first and third lines of the first stanza are repeated or echoed alternately in stanzas 2 and 4, to be lost, that their loss is no disaster. That's echoed in the last line of stanza 3 and stanza 5. And that those 2 lines, again modified possibly, become the last 2 lines of the poem as a whole. So there's this complicated pattern of echoes and changes and shifts, and you feel you're walking around the words, the given words of the first stanza, as if you're walking around a sculpture or it's moving around on a kind of turntable, so that you're seeing it from different angles and in different ways. And that kind of movement, of course, has become infinitely more possible and to be played with by all of us with new technology. Now, let me just read the poem. It's called One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther. Losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of 3 loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost 2 cities, lovely ones. And vaster, some realms I owned, 2 rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. Now, it seems clear what it's saying, this poem, but of course it's ironic. The point is the opposite of what's ostensibly argued. No one would suppose that it's really a recommendation that you should lose things, that losing things is not an easy but a good idea. And if it were, it would be advice that one couldn't follow. If you were trying to lose things, you wouldn't lose them, would you? You couldn't act on it. As the poem goes on, the stakes are increased from losing your door keys or somebody else's door keys to forgetting where you're going to losing personal possessions and habitations on a larger and larger scale, 3 loved houses, a continent. So the you of the poem, by this logic of progression, is someone very important indeed, more important than realms or continents, more important than rivers. Now, so far, it's so controlled. One Art, the poem is called, and it's manifestly, if ironically, a work of artifice. It also making a joke about becoming sophisticated at loss, being accomplished at it, being accomplished at disaster, so that being good at disaster could be thought to be making an art of your life. But perhaps One Art also implies as a title that there's no distinction between what's said in the poem and what the poem is. Villanelle, as a form, is an extreme example of how rhyme can determine what happens in a poem. Anybody who's tried to write a rhyming poem will know that occasionally the rhyme will force you to find a word which may not have been what you were thinking of, and introduce a meaning that you hadn't realized was going to be there. And then the art becomes, how do you deal with this rhyme that's taking control? Do you just let it go and write doggerel, or do you say, well, no, that word won't do, or I'm going to have to change the first word so that something else will rhyme with it? But sooner or later, the form will begin to take over from you and produce and generate its own words and phrases. And so from this point of view, there are two crucial elements, it seems to me, in the last stanza. One is that the formal control, as well as the emotional control, breaks down, very slightly but tellingly, in that parenthesis and repetition and italicization, write it, with the implication that she doesn't want to write it. She doesn't want to admit to what she's actually saying, which is that losing all these things isn't so bad, but losing this person is a disaster. I've lost the thread slightly. There is in that breakdown a change in the whole structure of what the poem has been saying. It disobeys its own formal rules. You're supposed to repeat their loss is no disaster, but by the end, and she's saying it wasn't a disaster, but by the end she's saying it is, or at least it looks like disaster. T.S. Eliot, writing about Dante, said, "Form is not a framework, but an instrument of research." In other words, it's through form that you find out what you want to say. That's a crude summary of a complicated point. In poetry, this is a quotation, "form is not a framework, but an instrument of research." Now, thinking back over the syllabus, there are a number of prose works which can be thought of in similar ways. Both their writing as writing and their writing about writing. And you could do that with the passage from A Portrait on page 3. I'm not going to do it for you. Or you could do it with the Kafka story, The Men Running Past, on page 4. That's a complete story in itself. As you know, if you've got that selection, you don't need anything else. It's not an extract. But I want to turn this question on its head now by asking you to think whether there are texts in which the writing doesn't crucially matter, the approach to writing and to style is not crucially important. I think there is an essential fault line between writers and readers, just a gap between writers and readers to whom style is of primary importance, Nabokov, shall we say, and those to whom what is being said is of primary importance. And in our syllabus, you might want to ask yourself where somebody like Ngugi stands in all this. The ironic thing about Ngugi's text, of course, is that he's written it in the language of the people he's writing against. So he has chosen already an idiom which he might be thought to be in rebellion against. And when you know that he repudiated the English language after his imprisonment in 1978, and he subsequently wrote in Gikuyu. Paradoxically, though, the classic statement of his belief that Africans should no longer write in colonial languages, but should produce Afro-European literature, occurs in an English language book, Decolonizing the Mind, The Politics of Language in African Literature. That's an issue to do with language in the sense of whether or not you use this language rather than another language. But there's also an issue of style there, which is that Ngugi is so concerned that we should understand the politics of what is being communicated, that to put style to the center of attention might be arguably to distract attention from that. The issue that we've talked about before between writing as a way of giving you a kind of transparent screen through which you are shown something, and writing as something like a stained glass in which you're partly focusing on what is on the surface, on the glass itself, rather than on what's on the other side of it. Are there texts, then, in which the style really not only doesn't matter, but in which an attention to style would be to confuse things? Orwell, of course, stands in the middle on this because of his interesting views on plainness and simplicity and clarity, but his insistence at the same time that writing about something has to be turned into an art. How is it that he actually does that? Does he actually do it? There are also issues to do with the importance of meaning in itself. I talked about just now about how the form of a piece of writing can almost determine the meaning, how meanings come out almost despite what the writer set out to do. And indeed, there have been writers who have quite willingly changed a word to its opposite if they think it'll work better. Lowell would change and to but, or put a word, put not into a sentence if he thought the rhythm was better, even though it said completely the opposite of what he'd originally meant to say. But there are other writers to whom that would be impossible. And by extension, stage writers to whom one way of doing their play is wrong and another way of doing it is right. A paradoxical effect of wanting to avoid attention to style, in the same way as somebody might want to avoid attention to the clothes they were wearing, is that you're almost bound in seeking to avoid that attention, to adopt a traditional style, a familiar style. So that a question I want to put to you is to think about right across your studies in the next couple of years, is there some way in which a focus on meaning must come at the cost of art, must come at the cost of the quality of the writing? There's a very interesting debate going on at the moment between world literature people who say we must read as much as we can, albeit in translation, of the world's cultures because this breaks away from insularity. It enables us to apprehend the world as a world and ourselves as something other than inhabitants of a small island which happens to speak a widely understood world language. Against that are those who say, and Tim Parks has written about this, a very, very good English novelist who lives in Italy and works a lot on translation as well as, and in translation as a writer. He says, no, that's absolute nonsense, because there's a danger that if you read everything in translation, you're being lured into a world in which what is published is what is readily translatable and readily appreciated in translation. But many of the most important texts in any given culture are the ones which don't lend themselves to translation because they don't conform to stereotypes or because their language is too difficult to render, they're too dependent on language. That, of course, would be an argument not for for focusing on the language you understand, but also, I would say, for learning another language so that you can really apprehend the literature of another country in that way. Are there then dangers in the world literature approach, which would be roughly to do with the fact that it prioritizes meaning over form and over the considerations I've been talking about? For myself, I think the arguments are very finely balanced. I wouldn't want a world in which I couldn't read things because they were in languages that I didn't understand. But I would hate a world in which everything I read came at me mediated in that way. So for that reason, among others, we're particularly lucky that we're English speakers, most of us, primarily first language English speakers. But we must remember, in being conscious of that good fortune, that to say, I'm going to read your literature, you Hindus, you Chinese, you Israelis, you Arabs, in translation, and then I'll understand what you're on about, is implicitly a colonial position, because it says, you know, I don't need to really know anything about your culture. I don't need to get your language. I'll get it in English, thanks very much. And thank you very much. Now, I said I'd take any questions. A few minutes. Are there any burning issues to do with this exam? I'll give you one piece of advice, which I've said already to my students in my own group, which is, although you've got all these weeks to think about it, don't go in with too over-prepared answers. It's a bit like preparing for a race. I think the spontaneity of the exam room, we've got 2 hours, you're going to write a roughly equal amount on each of two questions. That can generate thoughts and ideas in itself. If you're almost memorizing an essay and going in and trotting it out, it'll be boring. It'll be boring to you, and therefore it'll be boring to the reader. Try to leave yourself something in reserve. And one way of doing that, I think, is to read something new but related in the week before, rather than, you know, as I say, memorizing every word of your pre-prepared answer. Questions? All clear? Okay, the other thing is it doesn't matter. Yeah, there's a question. The question, the rubric's fairly clear that you can bring it, you can show the range of your knowledge, but at some point you should focus on one or other of the set texts. So the focus should be a set text or a group of set texts, but you're free to range more widely. And you know, you need to make sure that that range is being used in a relevant way, not just to show off. You're not going to get ticks and points for every text you mention or something. But obviously, somebody who can contextualize a set text against other work by the same author or other work of the same period or references across the whole syllabus outside the question being answered will be producing something more interesting to themselves as well as to the reader. That's what writing is about, essay writing like anything else. It's trying to interest somebody on the other side of all this. If you don't care about what the examiner... Well, you know, it's not like a school exercise. We're not ticking boxes. Did they mention this? Did they mention that? We're human beings on the other side of this. We're faced with a whole stack of essays. If they're all the same, we'll go to sleep. If they differ and have interesting things to say, we'll wake up and suddenly the marks will rocket. Yeah.
How fine is the line drawn between biographical reading and
How far is the line drawn between biographical reading and contextualizing? Well, biographical reading can be contextualizing. If your biographical reading is too much reading the text as illustrations of the writer, that is not the way to go.
You can contextualize as far as you want with the author's life
Yeah. The main thing is to focus on the text and how the text works. And if the writer's biographical circumstances, as in the case of Nemirovsky, for example, are part of the impact of the text on the reader, as they can't not be in that case, fine.
The last question said that we could look across other art forms.
You could what?
You can compare literary...
Yeah. Yeah, great.
But seeing as theatre is already counted in the syllabus through yeah. Godot, are we able to talk about theatre or is that...
Yeah. Yes. I see what you mean, that it doesn't... to what extent is it another art form? Yeah. You'd have to make the case... You'd have to say, well, you know, there only one play has been set, and actually drama is often much freer than this one. And yeah, you'd have to make the case. But as with your approach to any answer in this subject, any topic in this subject, your ability to make the case for doing things in your way is what counts. You need to read this because this. Don't feel cowed by the questions, and don't try to second guess what the person on the other side is expecting by way of answer. It's much more to do with making that person sit up and think, "Oh yeah, I haven't ever thought about that." And you can do that. One of the great beauties of this subject is that there are always things that can come out that. Haven't been thought of by anybody before. Okay? Good. Good luck. And it doesn't matter, by the way. As long as you pass, you're fine.